Hello, I'm Sean Finnegan, and you are listening to Restitutio, a podcast to get you thinking about biblical and historical Christianity, to inspire you to follow Christ, and to convict you to lead a consecrated life. Today's episode is The Historicity of the Resurrection of Jesus by William Lane Craig. How do we know God really raised Jesus of Nazareth from the dead? If I say, the Bible tells me so, what's the obvious next question? How do you know that the Bible is true? Of course, then, I would need to launch into a full-on defense of biblical inspiration. But what if there were another way, a shortcut? Rather than assume or prove the Bible is God's inspired book, what if we could still demonstrate that the thesis, God raised Jesus from the dead, is the best explanation of the historical evidence? This is precisely what William Lane Craig does in this excellent presentation. He identifies four historical facts that believers and skeptics alike agree happened: the honorable burial, the empty tomb, the appearance experiences, and the belief in Jesus' resurrection. Join Craig, one of the finest apologists of the 21st century, as he lays out the historical case for Jesus' resurrection with clarity and cogency.
Man, writes Lauren Isley, is the cosmic orphan. He's the only creature in the universe who asks why. Other animals have instincts to guide them, but man has learned to ask questions. Who am I, he asks. Why am I here? Where am I going? Well, ever since the Enlightenment, when modern man threw off the shackles of religion, he's tried to answer those questions without reference to God. But the answers that came back were not exhilarating, but dark and terrible. You are the accidental byproduct of nature, the result of matter plus time plus chance. There is no reason for your existence. All you face is death. Modern man thought that in divesting himself of God, he had freed himself from everything that stifled and oppressed him. Instead, he discovered that in killing God, he had unwittingly orphaned himself. It is against this dark background of the modern predicament that the traditional Christian hope in the resurrection takes on an even greater brightness and significance. For it tells man that he is no orphan after all, but rather the personal image of the Creator God of the universe. Nor is his life doomed to end in death. Rather, through the resurrection, he can live in the presence of God forever. Now, this is undoubtedly a wonderful hope. But of course, hope that is not founded on fact is not hope at all, but mere wishful thinking. Why should the Christian hope of resurrection from the dead appear to modern man as anything more than mere illusion and fantasy? Well, the answer lies in the Christian conviction that a man has been raised from the dead in advance by God as the forerunner and exemplar of our own resurrection from the dead. And that man was, of course, Jesus of Nazareth. And it is his historical resurrection from the dead that forms the factual foundation upon which the Christian hope is based. Now, of course, during the 19th century, liberal theology had no use for a historical resurrection of Jesus, since liberal theologians retained the presupposition against the possibility of miracles, which they had inherited from the deists. The idea of a historical resurrection from the dead was simply ruled out of court by them. And this skepticism with respect to the resurrection of Jesus remained unrelieved during the first half of the 20th century by either the dominant schools of dialectical or existential theology. But a remarkable change transpired during the second half of the 20th century. By 1968, the old skepticism was a spent force and then began very dramatically to recede. In fact, so complete has been the turnaround during the second half of the 20th century with respect to the resurrection of Jesus that I think that it is no exaggeration to speak of a reversal of scholarship on this issue. Perhaps the most startling indication of this was the declaration by one of the world's leading Jewish theologians, the late Pincus Lapid, who taught at Hebrew University in Tel Aviv, that he was convinced, on the basis of the evidence, that the God of Israel raised Jesus of Nazareth from the dead. Lapid twits skeptical New Testament critics like Bultmann and Markson for their unjustified skepticism, and concludes that he believes, on the basis of the evidence, that Yahweh raised Jesus of Nazareth from the dead. Well, what are the facts that go to undergird this remarkable reversal of opinion with respect to the credibility of the New Testament accounts of the resurrection of Jesus? It seems to me that they can be conveniently grouped under three broad heads: the resurrection appearances, the empty tomb, and the very origin of the Christian faith itself. And I'd like to look briefly at each one of these with you this morning. First, the post-mortem appearances of Jesus alive from the dead. Undoubtedly, the major impetus for the reassessment of the appearance traditions was the demonstration by the German New Testament scholar Joachim Jeremias that in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 3 to 5, Paul is quoting from an old Christian tradition or formula which he himself had received and then in turn passed on to his converts. Paul says, "For I delivered to you what I also received." And then he begins to quote this ancient Christian tradition that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. Then he appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time, most of whom are still alive, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared also to me. Now, according to his letter to the churches of Galatia in chapter 1 and verse 18, Paul was in Jerusalem 3 years after his conversion on the Damascus Road on a fact-finding mission, during which time he conferred with both Peter and James over a 2-week period. And he probably received the formula at this time, if not even earlier. Now, when you remember that Jesus was crucified in A.D. 30 and that Paul was converted in A.D. 33, that means that this list of witnesses to the resurrection appearances goes back to within the first 5 years after Jesus' crucifixion. And thus it is idle to try to dismiss these as merely legendary appearance accounts. According to John Dominic Crossan, one of the leading American New Testament critics, it would take at least 5 to 10 years for the early church to invent the passion story of Jesus based upon Old Testament motifs. But notice that this list of resurrection appearances precedes even that lower bound set by Crossan of 5 years. And Crossan admits that you cannot explain the resurrection of Jesus based upon inferences from Old Testament motifs, because there simply aren't any conspicuous Old Testament motifs that would lead the early church to invent the resurrection appearances of Jesus. And thus we can try to explain away these appearances as hallucinations if we want to, but we cannot responsibly deny that they occurred. Paul's information makes it certain that on separate occasions, various individuals and groups of people experienced appearances of Jesus alive after his death. According to Gerhard Ludemann, perhaps the most prominent German New Testament critic of the resurrection, it is historically certain, and those are his words, not mine, it is historically certain that Peter and the disciples had experiences after Jesus' death, in which Jesus appeared to them as the risen Christ. And today this conclusion is virtually indisputable and universally acknowledged among New Testament scholars. At the same time that biblical scholarship has come to a new appreciation of the historical credibility of Paul's information, however, it must be admitted that skepticism concerning the appearance traditions in the Gospels persists. But this lingering skepticism seems to me to be entirely unjustified. It is based upon a presuppositional antipathy or bias toward the physicalism of the gospel appearance stories. Jesus appears bodily and physically alive from the dead. And because of a philosophical presupposition against the possibility of nature miracles, the majority of critics are skeptical of these appearance narratives in the Gospels. But that is, as I say, a philosophical presupposition which New Testament scholars are frankly ill-equipped to address. That is a philosophical issue, the settling of which lies outside the area of expertise of New Testament scholars. The traditions underlying these gospel appearance stories may well be just as reliable as Paul's information. It's interesting that the physicalism of the gospel appearance stories is a feature of those stories that is multiply and independently attested in the New Testament. And this is one of the most important criteria of historicity that New Testament scholars use today. Indeed, this element of the gospel appearance stories is universal. It is unanimous in all of the sources. There is no trace of visionary, non-physical, non-corporeal appearances in the source material for the appearance stories of Jesus. And thus, by the standard canons of New Testament scholarship, this aspect or feature of the narrative ought to be accepted as historical because it's multiply and independently attested in all of our sources. And thus, I find current criticism with regard to these appearance traditions in the Gospels to be quite unwarranted. It is based upon a philosophical prejudice rather than upon historical concerns. And I think that the new appreciation of the historical credibility of Paul's information needs to be accompanied by a reassessment of the gospel traditions as well. Secondly, the empty tomb. Once regarded as an offense to modern intelligence and even an embarrassment to Christian theology, the empty tomb of Jesus has come to assume its place among the generally accepted facts concerning the historical Jesus. Let me review briefly just some of the evidence that undergirds this conclusion. Number one, the historical reliability of the burial account supports the empty tomb. Now, you might say to me, well, how does the reliability of the burial story support the historicity of the empty tomb? Well, very simply in the following way. If the burial account is accurate, then the site of Jesus' grave was known in Jerusalem to both Jew and Christian alike. And in that case, it is a very short inference to the historicity of the empty tomb. For if Jesus had not risen from the dead and the burial site were known, then in the first place, the disciples could never have believed in the resurrection of Jesus. For a first century Jew, the idea that a man might be raised from the dead while his body still remained in the tomb was simply a contradiction in terms. In the words of E.E. Ellis, it is very unlikely that the earliest Palestinian Christians could conceive of any distinction between resurrection and physical grave emptying resurrection. To them, he says, a resurrection without an empty grave would have been about as meaningful as a square circle. But secondly, even if the disciples had believed in the resurrection of Jesus, it's doubtful that they would have generated any following. So long as the body remained interred in the tomb, a Christian movement founded upon belief in the resurrection of the dead man would have been an impossible folly. But thirdly, in any case, the Jewish authorities would have quickly exposed the whole affair. The quickest and surest answer to the disciples' proclamation, "He is risen from the dead," would have been simply to point to the grave in the hillside. Or, if necessary, even go to the extreme measures of exhuming the body and parading it through the streets of Jerusalem for all to see that he wasn't risen from the dead. So, for these three reasons, then, the accuracy of the burial story supports the historicity of the empty tomb. Unfortunately, for those who wish to deny the empty tomb, the burial account is widely regarded as one of the most historically credible traditions that we have concerning Jesus. According to the late New Testament scholar of Cambridge University, John A.T. Robinson, the honorable burial of Jesus in the tomb is one of the earliest and best attested facts about Jesus. But if that is the case, then, as I've explained, the inference that the tomb was found empty is not very far at hand. Number two, Paul's testimony supports the fact of the empty tomb. Now, here are two aspects of Paul's testimony may be mentioned. First, in the ancient tradition cited by Paul, the expression, "and he was raised," following the phrase, "he was buried," implies an empty tomb. A first century Jew could not have thought otherwise. As E.L. Bode observes in his very fine study of the empty tomb, the notion of the occurrence of a spiritual resurrection while the body remained in the tomb is a peculiarity of modern theology. And this point has recently been demonstrated in spades by N.T. Wright, a British New Testament scholar, in his book, The Resurrection of the Son of God, in which he shows that it is unanimous in the ancient world that resurrection from the dead meant the reanimation of the physical corpse in the grave, not some sort of a spiritual event. For Jews, it was the remains of the person in the tomb that were raised, principally the bones of the dead that were the object of the resurrection. And hence, Jewish funerary practices were to preserve the bones of the dead in ossuaries or limestone boxes until the eschatological resurrection at the end of history. There can be no doubt that both Paul and the early Christian tradition that he cites presuppose the existence of the empty tomb. Second aspect of Paul's testimony I want to mention is the phrase, "on the third day," where Paul says, "and he was raised on the third day." I think that this probably points to the discovery of the empty tomb. Very briefly summarized, the point here is simply this. Since nobody actually saw Jesus of Nazareth get up and walk out of the tomb, why did Christians come to date it on the third day? Why not on the tenth day or on the seventh day? Well, I think the most probable answer to this question is that they did so because it was on this day that the tomb was discovered empty by the group of Jesus' women followers, and hence the resurrection itself naturally came to be dated on that day. And thus, in this early Christian tradition cited by Paul, we have extremely early evidence for the historicity of Jesus' empty tomb. Number three, the empty tomb story is part of the pre-Markan passion story and is therefore very old. And I think at this point it would be appropriate to read Mark's account of the discovery of the empty tomb as it's narrated in chapter 16, verses 1 to 8. "And when the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Salome, brought spices so that they might go and anoint him. And very early, on the first day of the week, they went to the tomb when the sun had risen. And they were saying to one another, 'Who will roll away the stone for us from the door of the tomb?' And looking up, they saw that the stone was rolled back, for it was very large. And entering the tomb, they saw a young man sitting on the right side, dressed in a white robe, and they were amazed. And he asked them, or pardon me, and he said to them, do not be amazed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter that he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you. And they went out and fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had come upon them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. Now, this empty tomb narrative was probably the end of Mark's passion source, the source for the story of Jesus' suffering and death. Now, since Mark is already the earliest of our Gospels, this source, therefore, itself is even older. In fact, the Markan commentator Rudolf Pesch maintains that it is an incredibly early source, and he produces two lines of evidence for this conclusion. First, Pesch notes that Paul's account of the Last Supper in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 23 to 25, is even more, not as primitive a tradition as the Markan account. He thinks that Mark's account of the Last Supper is even more primitive than the account given in 1 Corinthians 11. Now, since Paul's own traditions, as we've seen, are quite old, that means that this pre-Markan passion source must be even older. Secondly, he observes that the pre-Markan passion story never refers to the high priest by name. It's as if I were to say the prime minister is hosting a dinner at number 10 Downing Street, and everybody would know whom I was speaking about, namely the man that's currently in office. Now, similarly, the pre-Markan passion story simply refers to the high priest, as if he were still in power. Since Caiaphas held office from AD 18 to 37, that means that at the latest, this pre-Markan passion source would have to come from within 7 years after Jesus' death. And thus, this source goes back to within the very first few years of the Jerusalem Fellowship, and is therefore a very ancient and valuable source of historical information. Number four, the story itself is simple and lacks signs of legendary development. The empty tomb story is uncolored by the theological and apologetical motifs that would be characteristic of a later legendary account. Now, perhaps the most forceful way to appreciate this point is to simply compare the account of the empty tomb in Mark's narrative with the accounts found in the apocryphal Gospels from the second century and later after Christ. For example, in the Gospel of Peter, the tomb is surrounded not only by a Roman guard, but also by all of the scribes and the chief priests and Pharisees, as well as a huge crowd from the surrounding countryside. Suddenly, during the night, a voice rings out in heaven, and the stone over the door of the tomb rolls back by itself. Then two men are seen descending out of heaven and entering into the tomb. Then three men are seen coming out of the tomb, two of the men supporting the third. The heads of the two men reach up to the clouds, but the head of the third man overpasses the clouds. Then a cross comes out of the tomb, and a voice from heaven asks, "Hast thou preached to them that sleep?" And the cross answers, "Yea." Now, these are how real legends look. They're embellished with all sorts of theological and apologetical motifs, motifs which are conspicuously lacking from the Markan account, which is, by comparison, stark in its simplicity. Number five, the tomb was probably discovered empty by women. To understand this point, you need to recall two facts about the role of women in Jewish society. First of all, women occupied a low rung on the Jewish social ladder. This is evident in such rabbinic expressions as the following: "Sooner let the words of the law be burnt than delivered to women." Or again, "Blessed is he whose children are male, but woe to him whose children are female." Quite frankly, in a patriarchal society, women were regarded as second-class citizens. Secondly, the testimony of women was regarded as so worthless that, according to Josephus, they were not even permitted to serve as legal witnesses in a court of law. If a man were caught red-handed or observed by a group of women to be committing a crime, he couldn't be convicted on the basis of their testimony, because the testimony of women was regarded as so unreliable, it wouldn't even be admitted into court. Now, in light of these facts, how remarkable must it seem that it is women who are the discoverers of Jesus' empty tomb? Any later legend would certainly have made male disciples like Peter and John to be the discoverers of the empty tomb. The fact that women, whose testimony was worthless rather than men, are the chief witnesses to the fact of the empty tomb is most plausibly accounted for by the fact that, like it or not, they were the discoverers of the empty tomb, and the gospel writers accurately record what, for them, was a rather awkward and embarrassing fact. Number six, the earliest Jewish polemic presupposes the empty tomb. In Matthew chapter 28, we find the Christian attempt to refute the earliest Jewish polemic against the disciples' proclamation of the resurrection. Now, what were Jews saying in response to the disciples' proclamation, "He is risen from the dead," that his tomb still lay there, occupied in the hillside, that these men are full of new wine? No, they said the disciples came and stole away his body. Now think about that for a minute. The disciples came and stole away his body. The earliest Jewish polemic was itself an attempt to explain away the empty tomb, why the corpse was missing. And thus we have evidence for the empty tomb, which is absolutely top drawer, because it comes not from the Christians themselves, but from the very opponents of the early Christian movement. Now, I could go on, but I think enough has been said to indicate why the judgment of scholarship has reversed itself with respect to the historicity of the empty tomb. According to Jakob Kramer, who is an Austrian specialist in the resurrection, by far most exegetes hold firmly to the reliability of the biblical statements of the empty tomb, and he furnishes a list to which his own name can be added of 28 prominent scholars in support. I can think of more than 20 additional names that one might add to this list. According to D.H. Van Dalen, it is extremely difficult to object to the empty tomb on historical grounds. Those who deny it, he says, do so on the basis of theological or philosophical assumptions. But again, assumptions may simply need to be changed in light of historical facts. Finally, we can turn to that third body of evidence supporting the resurrection, the very origin of the Christian way itself. Even the most skeptical scholars admit that the earliest disciples at least believed that Jesus had been raised from the dead. Indeed, they pinned nearly everything on it. Without belief in the resurrection of Jesus, early Christianity could never have come into being. The crucifixion would have remained the final tragedy in the hapless life of the prophet from Nazareth. And thus the origin of the Christian movement itself hinges upon the belief of these early disciples that God had raised Jesus of Nazareth from the dead. But now the question inevitably arises, how does one explain the origin of that belief? As R.H. Fuller urges, even the most skeptical critic must posit some mysterious X to get the movement going. But the question is, what was that X? Well, if one denies that that mysterious missing factor was the event of the resurrection itself, then he must explain the disciples' belief that Jesus rose from the dead, either in terms of Christian influences, pagan influences, or Jewish influences. Now, clearly, It could not have been the result of Christian influences for the simple reason that there wasn't any Christianity yet. Since belief in the resurrection of Jesus lay at the very foundations of the Christian movement, it cannot be explained away as a later creation of that movement, since without that belief, the movement would not have come into being. Well, what about pagan influences? Back around the turn of the 18th to 19th centuries, scholars in the history of religions ransacked the literature of ancient pagan mythology in the attempt to find parallels to Christian beliefs like the virgin birth, the incarnation, the resurrection, and so forth. And some of them actually sought to explain the origin of Christian beliefs on the basis of these pagan influences. The movement soon collapsed, however, and that principally for two reasons. Number one, it turned out that the parallels were spurious. That is to say, these were not genuine parallels to the Christian belief. In particular, myths of dying and rising gods in pagan mythology, like myths of Osiris and Adonis and Tammuz, turn out to be either not resurrections at all — Osiris merely lives on in the underworld, he does not in fact return to life — or else they're mere symbols of the crop cycle, as the vegetation dies every year in the dry season and then comes back to life in the rainy season. It has absolutely nothing to do with historical resurrection from the dead. So that in fact the Jewish belief in the resurrection of the dead is a belief that is unparalleled in ancient pagan religion. But secondly, in any case, there was no causal connection between these pagan myths and the earliest disciples of Jesus. As Martin Hengel has observed, Jews were aware of these pagan myths and found them heinous and despicable. And therefore, you find no trace of worship of dying and rising gods anywhere in first century Palestine until the time of Hadrian in the second century after Christ. As Hans Grass, the German New Testament scholar, has said, it is simply unthinkable that these earliest disciples of Jesus could have come to believe that Jesus was literally and historically risen from the dead because they had heard of pagan myths of Osiris and Adonis in these crop deities returning to life again. But then what about Jewish influences? Well, in order to examine this, we need to back up a moment. In the Old Testament, Jewish belief in the resurrection of the dead on the Day of Judgment is mentioned in three places: Ezekiel 37, Isaiah 26:19, and Daniel 12:2. During the intertestamental period, belief in the resurrection of the dead flourished and became a widespread Jewish belief. It's often mentioned in Jewish literature from this period. In Jesus' own day, the Jewish party of the Pharisees held to belief in the resurrection, and it's very interesting that on this score at least, Jesus sided with the Pharisees in opposition to the Sadducees. So the idea of resurrection from the dead was itself nothing new in Judaism. But the Jewish conception of resurrection differed in two important fundamental respects from Jesus' resurrection. In Jewish thinking, the resurrection of the dead always, always, number one, occurred after the end of the world, not within history. And secondly, it always concerned all the people, not just an isolated individual. In contradistinction to this, Jesus' resurrection was both within history and of one individual person. The renowned German New Testament scholar Joachim Jeremias writes, "Ancient Judaism did not know of an anticipated resurrection as an event of history. Nowhere does one find in the literature anything comparable to the resurrection of Jesus. Certainly revivifications of the dead were known, but these always concerned resuscitations, the return to the earthly life. In no place in the late Judaic literature does it concern a resurrection to glory as an event of history." The disciples, therefore, confronted with Jesus' crucifixion and death, could at best have simply preserved their master's tomb as a shrine where his bones might reside until the eschatological resurrection at the end of history, when they and all the righteous dead of Israel would be reunited with him in the kingdom of God. But they would not have come to believe the outlandish and un-Jewish idea that he was somehow already risen from the dead. The disciples' belief in Jesus' resurrection, therefore, cannot be plausibly explained as a result of either Christian influences, pagan influences, or Jewish influences. Left to themselves, the disciples would never have come to believe such an un-Jewish idea as the resurrection of Jesus. And remember, they were tax collectors and fishermen, not theologians. The mysterious X is still missing. According to C.F.D. Mole of Cambridge University, here is a belief which nothing in terms of historical influences can account for. He points out that we have here a situation in which a large number of people held firmly to this belief, which cannot be explained in terms of the Old Testament or the Pharisees, and that these people held tenaciously to this belief until they were finally squeezed out of the synagogue. According to Professor Mole, the origin of this belief must have been the fact that Jesus really did rise from the dead. He writes, "If the coming into existence of the Nazarenes, a phenomenon undeniably attested by the New Testament, rips a great hole in history, a hole the size and shape of the resurrection, what does the secular historian propose to stop it up with? The birth and rapid rise of the Christian church remain an unsolved enigma for any historian who refuses to take seriously the only explanation offered by the church itself." So, taken together then, these three great independently established facts, the resurrection appearances, the discovery of the empty tomb, the very origin of the Christian faith, all seem to point to the resurrection of Jesus as the most plausible explanation. But of course, there have been other explanations proffered down through history to account for the resurrection appearances, the empty tomb, and the origin of the Christian faith. In the judgment of modern scholarship, however, these have failed to provide a plausible account of the facts of the case. And I think this can be seen by just a very rapid overview of the principal explanations that have been offered. First counter-explanation, the conspiracy theory. According to this theory, the disciples stole the body of Jesus and lied about the resurrection appearances. This explanation characterized the earliest Jewish polemic, as we have seen, and it was revived in the form of the conspiracy theory of 18th century deism. Today, however, the theory has been universally rejected by critical scholarship, and it survives only in the popular press or in former propaganda from behind the Iron Curtain. To name only two considerations which are decisive against it, number one, it is morally impossible to indict the disciples of Jesus with such a crime. Whatever their imperfections, they were certainly good and earnest men and women, not imposters. Nobody who reads the New Testament unprejudicially can doubt that these people sincerely believed the truth of this message that they proclaimed and were willing to go to their deaths for. Secondly, it's psychologically impossible to attribute to the disciples the cunning and daring do requisite for such a ruse. At the time of the crucifixion, the disciples were confused, disorganized, fearful, doubting, burdened with mourning, not at all motivated or equipped to engineer such a wild hoax. Indeed, I think that the Achilles heel of the conspiracy theory is that it really cannot take seriously what a catastrophe the crucifixion was for any faith that the disciples might have entertained that Jesus was the Messiah. Jewish beliefs had no anticipation of a Messiah who, instead of conquering Israel's enemies and restoring the throne of David, would be humiliatingly executed by them as a criminal, much less that he would then be raised from the dead. The conspiracy theory is anachronistic in that it looks back on the crucifixion through the lenses of the Christian church rather than through the eyes of a first century Palestinian Jew. And so to try to explain away the empty tomb and the resurrection appearances by a conspiracy theory is simply out of the question. Secondly, the apparent death theory. According to this theory, Jesus did not really die on the cross, but was taken down and placed alive in the tomb where he revived and escaped to convince the disciples that he had risen from the dead. Now, this apparent death theory was championed by late 18th and early 19th century German rationalists. And sad to say, it was even embraced by the so-called father of modern theology, F.D.E. Schleiermacher. Today, however, the theory has been entirely given up. Number one, it would have been virtually impossible medically for Jesus to have survived the rigors of his torture and crucifixion, much less not to have died almost immediately of exposure in the tomb had he still been alive. And I think it's one of the merits of Mel Gibson's film, The Passion of the Christ, to vividly portray how patently absurd this apparent death theory really is. Secondly, the theory is explanatorily inadequate in any case, since a half-dead Jesus, desperately in need of medical attention and bandaging, would hardly have elicited in the disciples the worship of him as the exalted, risen Lord and the conqueror of death. Moreover, since on this hypothesis Jesus had not actually triumphed over death, the theory reduces him to a charlatan who tricked the disciples into believing he had risen, which is simply absurd. And so for these reasons alone, the apparent death theory is untenable. Thirdly, the hallucination theory. According to this hypothesis, the disciples projected hallucinations of Jesus after his death, from which they mistakenly inferred that he was risen from the dead. Now, the hallucination theory became popular during the 19th century, and it carried over into the first half of the 20th century as well. Most recently, it has been revived by Gerhard Ludemann, who proposes to explain the appearances on the basis of guilt-induced hallucinations on the part of Peter and Paul. But again, I think there are good grounds for rejecting the hallucination hypothesis. Number one, it is psychologically implausible to posit such a chain of hallucinations. Hallucinations are usually associated with either mental illness or substance abuse. But in the disciples' case, the prior psychobiological preparation was just wanting. The disciples had no anticipation of seeing Jesus alive again. All they could do would be to wait to be reunited with him in the kingdom of God at the end of history. There were no grounds leading them to hallucinate him alive from the dead. Moreover, the frequency and the variety of the circumstances break any parallels to any sort of hallucinatory experiences found in the psychological casebooks. There is nothing parallel in the psychological casebooks to these appearances of Jesus in hallucinatory experiences. Jesus was seen not just once, but many times. Not just by one person, but by several persons. Not only by individuals, but by groups of people. Not just at one locale and under one set of circumstances, but at many. Not by believers only, but also by skeptics and unbelievers as well. And the hallucination theory simply cannot be stretched to accommodate this kind of diversity. Number two, hallucinations would not in any case have led to belief in Jesus' resurrection. You see, as projections of one's own mind, hallucinations cannot contain anything that is not already in the mind. But we've already seen that Jesus' resurrection differed from the Jewish conception of resurrection in two fundamental ways. Given their Jewish frame of thought, the disciples, if they were to hallucinate, visions of Jesus, would have projected visions of Jesus in glory, in Abraham's bosom, in paradise, where they believed that Israel's righteous dead went to await the eschatological resurrection at the end of history. So that at most, hallucinations of Jesus would have led them to proclaim Jesus' assumption into heaven, or his translation into heaven, which in Jewish thinking is a distinct category from resurrection from the dead. And thus hallucinations, had they occurred, would not have elicited belief in the resurrection of Jesus, an idea which, as we've seen, ran solidly against Jewish modes of thinking. Thirdly, the hallucination hypothesis fails to account for the full scope of the evidence. They are offered merely as an explanation of the post-mortem appearances, but they leave the empty tomb completely unexplained. And therefore, in order to explain the full scope of the evidence, you have to conjoin to the hallucination hypothesis some additional hypothesis in order to explain the empty tomb. By contrast, the resurrection hypothesis has a broader explanatory scope and therefore is to be preferred as the better explanation. Thus, none of the previous counter-explanations which have been offered can account for the evidence as plausibly as the resurrection itself. Now, this puts the skeptical critic in a somewhat awkward situation. For example, a few years ago, I had a debate at the University of California, Irvine, on the historicity of the resurrection of Jesus with a professor who had written his doctoral dissertation on the evidence for the resurrection. He was completely familiar with the evidence, and he could not deny the facts of Jesus' honorable burial, his empty tomb, his post-mortem appearances, or the origin of the disciples' belief in his resurrection. And so his only recourse was to come up with some alternative explanation of these facts. And so he argued that Jesus of Nazareth must have had an unknown identical twin brother who was separated from him at birth, unbeknownst to his parents, who then came back to Jerusalem just at the time of the crucifixion, stole the body out of the tomb and presented himself to the disciples, who mistakenly inferred that Jesus was risen from the dead. Now, I'm not going to go into how I went about refuting this theory, but I think it's illustrative because it shows to what desperate lengths skepticism must go in order to explain away the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. Well, you might say to me then, how can skeptical scholars explain the facts of the empty tomb, the resurrection appearances, and the origin of the Christian faith? Well, the fact of the matter is that most of these skeptical critics just don't offer any explanation. Modern scholarship recognizes no plausible, naturalistic explanation of these three facts. Those who refuse to accept the resurrection of Jesus as an event of history are simply self-confessedly left with no explanation. So in conclusion then, these three great independently established facts, the resurrection appearances, the discovery of the empty tomb, the origin of the Christian faith itself, all point unavoidably to one marvelous conclusion: the resurrection of Jesus. Today, the rational man can hardly be blamed if he believes that on that first Easter morning, a divine miracle occurred. The cosmic orphan can come home.
If you enjoyed what you heard here, why not give Restitutio a 5-star rating in iTunes or Stitcher? Doing so will help others find this podcast and inspire them to love God, follow Christ, and seek truth wherever it leads. Thanks for listening, and check us out online at restitutio.org, where you can find an archive of all the podcasts, as well as a bunch of articles and links to other resources. And remember, the truth has nothing to fear.